But you actually went to John Connolly asking for help.
That was a little bit later. Again, it's an information era that didn't exist. We had a phone. That was it. You had a phone. And if the wrong guy answers the phone on the other end, you know, it's a dead end. 4 days and literally a couple of weeks, I kind of picked my way around the Massachusetts State Police. Well, what about this guy? What about that guy? You know, somebody didn't want to help me. Well, who could help me? I eventually found a wonderful guy by the name of Rick Fralick. I said, Fralick, something's up. Fralick was a guy that a year or so previously, really before the Wheeler murder, they knew about Whitey Bulger and Steve Fleming. He actually participated in a surveillance where they actually rented an apartment across from one of their hangouts, a garage in North Boston. Fralick lived in the apartment. A lot of these pictures that you see, kind of a buff Whitey standing around a car, those are the pictures from my friend Rick Fralick. Then their surveillance got burned. And then they're thinking that there's something amiss. They're thinking that there's some corruption somewhere around them. They suspected the FBI, but it was in its infancy of discovery. Anyway, Fralick says, I'll help you. It took us a couple of weeks to put a trip together to Boston and Connecticut to figure out how we're going to address this. We partnered up. We found the guys in Connecticut that had discovered John Callahan being associated with these Winter Hill mobsters. And now we've discovered the guy in Massachusetts that had intricate knowledge of the Winter Hill mobster. So we all connected and we formed our own little task force. We traveled to Boston for about a week. And part of our goal in that was to find John Callahan. We figured John Callahan was ripe to turn into an informant. I wasn't a seasoned homicide detective at that time, but I was around plenty of guys that were. And John Callahan had the most to lose. He had the most normal life. He was just a wannabe mobster. He's the kind of guy that would roll over and turn into a snitch or witness immediately. So we're all over Boston looking for him, and we can't find him. The FBI knows we're there. We catch them following us around. We didn't know that these guys were all reporting back to John Connolly. So we put some heat on John Callahan, and ultimately the FBI has John Connolly do an alleged interview of John Callahan where he denies and refutes all involvement, and that's the official line. No, Brian Halloran's a liar. Our star agent, John Connolly, hooked up with John Callahan. He says no. So it's done. It's all over. You guys go back to Tulsa. In fact, I was absolutely told, if you're in our city, you need to clear it with me, an FBI agent, as to who you're going to talk to. If hitting a federal agent wasn't a crime. You know, I mean, I'm a young, muscled up guy that was a street cop that did a lot of fighting. There was a time where it was like, I'm going to have to just kick somebody's ass or get my ass kicked trying. So we knew that there was something really fishy going on. We couldn't find Callahan. So I go home. I believe it was August 2nd or 3rd. We had just been home a week or so. I get a phone call. I'm walking in the door. My phone's ringing at my home. The guy says, hey, are you Mike Huff from Tulsa PD? And I said, yeah. He goes, I'm Detective John Parmenter from the Metro-Dade PD. Were you looking for John Callahan?
Metro-Dade PD in Florida.
Florida, Dade County, South Florida, headquarters of World High Life. He said, were you looking for a John Callahan? And I said, yeah, we just got back in town a few days ago. You got him down there with you? He said, well, sort of. He's in a trunk of a car. He's all shot up. He's at the Miami International Airport, and he's got a dime on his chest. Drop a dime. For us that are old enough to realize the payphones that cost a dime and that connotation, I'm going to drop a dime on your ass, means I'm going to snitch you off. So I said, wow, that's interesting. I said, we'll be down there as soon as I can get there. We went down there. The case got assigned to a wonderful bull in a china closet detective named Shelton Merritt. His nickname was Grits, second generation South Florida cop. Their entire homicide unit was brand new because they had cleaned house over the cocaine cowboys hits of South Florida drug wars, which ended up involving homicide cops stealing hundreds of thousands of dollars out of these homicide scenes. So here I've got a brand new cop who is 6'5", chiseled in stone, street cop turned homicide cop. he and I hit it off really good together. I said, man, I don't know what's going on, but something's happening. He goes, well, I'm heading to Boston tonight, and I'm going to stay at an FBI agent's house. They're going to pick me up. I said, oh, my God. Put the brakes on that. He goes, oh, no, you know, blah, blah. And so sometime later, he realized that he had walked into the grips of hell with that and had to back away from being with the FBI. But the FBI had assisted him with the search warrant on an apartment. Callahan had a nice home in Winchester, Massachusetts, I believe, where he lived with his wife and kids. And then he had an apartment down on the wharf where he chased girls and whatever. They did a search warrant on that and retrieved some evidence.
You said Callahan was found in his car. There's a diamond in his chest. Who killed Callahan?
Well, later we found out that the killer of Roger Wheeler was Callahan's best friend and also Callahan's killer, and that was Johnny Margarano. In the time that we had gone to Boston looking for John Callahan, we were with everybody in the underworld, and we crossed paths with everybody in law enforcement. So it was no secret that we were down there. They had, and I say they, Fleming and Bulger, got a hold of Margarano and said, hey, we got to have a meeting. He flew into New York, went to the LaGuardia Marriott. They said, hey, Callahan's got to go. They're trying to pick him up. He won't stand up under the pressure. Then they involved some very intricate knowledge that they could have only gotten from their corrupt FBI agent, John Connolly. Johnny really didn't want to kill his best friend. He was staying in Callahan's condominium in Plantation, Florida, under a false name. And Callahan was the money man, and he would bring money to Johnny. They arranged for Callahan to bring money to Johnny.
In Florida.
In Florida, which was a routine deal. So Callahan, the end of August, headed to Florida, flew in actually the Fort Lauderdale airport. Johnny picked him up in a van that Johnny had. Joe McDonald was following Johnny. John Callahan should have known something was going on when he stepped into that van, which was covered with Visqueen, the entire interior of the van. They pulled away from the airport, and Johnny shot Callahan in the head. I think Joe McDonald maybe was driving Callahan's car, which he kept parked at the Miami International Airport. He had a Cadillac down there. And so they transferred the body from Johnny's van to Callahan's own vehicle, reparked the car at Miami International Airport. The dime just fell out of somebody's pocket. And for years, we speculated the meaning of that dime, which fits so good into the plot of the story. And then reparked the car at the airport. And a few days later, people smelled a smell coming from it. So by now, we're seeing, okay, Wheeler's dead. Halloran's dead. Callahan's dead. They have that common theme of a story. And the FBI is denying the connections like crazy, just like the government does today with the stuff where you go, my God, look at the story. And they say, no, that's not the story. You guys don't know what you're talking about, and we can't educate you, so leave. At the focal point was Paul Rico. I'm making trips back and forth to Miami to talk to Paul Rico, and it just turned into like a Columbo show. I'm getting older and a little bit wiser, a little bit less naive. He's getting a little bit older and cranky. We just didn't like each other.
You're kind of like Peter Falk then, aren't you?
Yeah, I guess if that's good or bad.
I thought that earlier.
It just wouldn't go away.
You kept coming back,
And really, literally, the entire time, we're just keeping this case on life support. We're not making any progress, but the case is not dying. So Dick Bishop and I are standing outside the Miami headquarters of World High Life. And we had just had a chess game BS interview with Rico. Rico just loved it because he thought he was making me look stupid. If he had just shut the door, it would have been better for him. But we're standing out there waiting for a cab. This guy, a former FBI agent, who was now and had been in the hierarchy of World High Life, came up to me. And he knew me because I had been in and out of there so many times. He said, I'm glad to see you here. I said, really? He said, yeah, I can't talk to you here, though. And we're thinking we're going to get like a deep throat kind of thing. He said, I am management supervision of night shift games tonight. They're running games that night, high life season. I said, well, we're just staying over by the airport, which wasn't too far from World High Line. I knew enough about this guy that he liked to drink. I said, let me call you and see how your night's going, and maybe I'll buy you a drink after you get off. He said, sure. So we tried to prepare ourselves and get ourselves psyched up and loose enough to have a really productive conversation with this guy. He shows up about 10:30 or 11, and we're at the bar. We'd had a couple drinks. We were a little bit loose, and so we had to get some drinks down him quick. And so we did, and he started loosening up, talking all around the edges. He goes, yeah, there's some stuff going on I'd like to talk to somebody about. We got him to the point where he broke down and was crying and saying, I never thought I would be around anything like this, but I can't tell you. And he had some personal reasons why he could not tell us that would really put him and his family in obvious harm's way. You know, there's already three people dead that we knew about. Well, actually, four people with Mike Donahue.
You said personal
reasons.
Yeah,
he had some personal reasons. If I say this, it will identify the guy, really. I mean, it might as well be his name. But he had a son that was in law enforcement that was not mixed up with this, but was at ground zero to it all. And so he was privy to some things on one end, and here his father, a retired FBI agent, was privy to things on the other end. He knew what was going on. He just could not, he couldn't do it. You know, you couldn't recreate that moment. So I tried to recreate it three or four times over the years with him, and it didn't go anywhere. We were that close.
He's crying. He said, I wish I wouldn't.
He is broken down and crying.
So where does it go from there?
After a few minutes, he regains his composure and gets up and walks off. It's like, oh my gosh. We felt like we were used car salesmen at the end of the month, and we just missed our quota. We let this buyer go. So we knew we were on the right track. I mean, that really solidified it right there. And so we started this cooperation between the state police in Massachusetts, the Connecticut State Police, and us. We just tried to form this unofficial task force. We couldn't go to Massachusetts every week or two. We just had to trust people to help us. Of course, there wasn't even a conference call mechanism at that time. We just had to work hard to maintain that. And some of us are still friends.